Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We meet around our kitchen table and we talk food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thank you to them, and thank you to you, our listeners, that help make this radio station run. Yes, it does. It is the start of summer. It's hot. People sliding into vacations. Oh, my goodness. Well, yes, we all got a little bit of hot this past weekend. Summer. It brings green grass and growing gardens and time spent outside. The warm weather also brings allergies, insects, dandelions, and all sorts of other plants that we call weeds. Today, we're going to be considering weeds, pests, and our enthusiastic use of chemical responses. Joining us here in the kitchen is Kamyar and Cheyenne.
Yes, Kamyar. Kamyar is the UNI director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education. Welcome, Kamyar.
Great to be with you.
Yes, and Kamyar is going to talk to us about a recent visitor to Iowa, Dr. Charles Benbrook, who came and gave a presentation about the kind of, can we call it the pesticide burden that we here in Iowa have?
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Kamyar, tell us who Chuck Benbrook is and why the tour of Iowa was sponsored and
yes.
What's up.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for having me on your show. So I'll tell you a little bit about kind of how this visit came about. For a long time, I've felt that we need more conversations about pesticides in Iowa.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of, as you've heard, there's a lot of talk about nutrient reduction and issues with water quality, and everything is focused on fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
And almost no conversation about millions of pounds of weed killers that are used on corn and beans, and what would be the consequence of public health consequences of that. So as a way of kind of starting that conversation, we hosted a gathering of all people in Iowa who are studying something about pesticides in Iowa. So that included, and we hosted that at the University of Iowa with the College of Public Health. The day before the Ames meeting that Dr. Benbrook spoke. And so he was also there the day before in that meeting in Iowa City. And in that meeting, we had about 35 people attend, and it really wasn't a public meeting necessarily. It was just a gathering of people we knew who were studying this issue, including the Pesticide Bureau from Iowa Department of Agriculture, the state toxicologist from Iowa Department of Health, as well as several faculty members in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, weed scientists from ISU, ISU Extension. And so, you know, just a wide variety of people who got together and compared notes about what's going on in Iowa, about pesticide drifts, about just what we know, who's doing what. It really was a very wonderful meeting, very useful meeting. And that was the meeting at which Dr. Benbrook spoke about, kind of shared his data that he had put together about what we know about the state of pesticides in Iowa.
Well, tell us who Dr. Benbrook is.
Yes. So Chuck Benbrook, He is a consultant right now. I mean, he has been doing consulting with a number of clients and entities around the U.S. and around the world. But he's a foremost scholar of really what we know about the health consequences of pesticides. He knows all about every pesticide, as well kind of the chemistry of them, as well as health consequences, as well as legal ramification and the law about pesticide. He used to work at the National Academy of Sciences Board on Agriculture. That's when I was in grad school. That's how I know of his work. And then he's just had a long career in pesticide public policy around pesticides, and he currently is a visiting scholar at Bloomberg School of Public Health, which is at Johns Hopkins University. So he has done a lot of he has published a lot on pesticides and public health, and so he like is an expert witness on a lot of legal cases of pesticide drift where there has been crop damage to neighboring farms. So we invited him to Iowa to kind of help us understand the latest trends and issues. So it was really wonderful to have him here.
And this was also sponsored by what Drake Ag Law Center?
The visit, yes. The visit in Ames was also sponsored by the Drake Ag Law Center, as well as the Pesticide Action Network,
right.
And that's an international organization that has a North American office. And they are active in Minnesota, Iowa, California, and Hawaii. And so one of their staff is in Iowa, and so they're working on, they've been working with Iowa Farmers Union and to some extent with PFI farmers in documenting drift, cases of drift, and basically learning more about it and educating and engaging Iowa Department of Ag in improving their pesticide reporting, things like that.
Well, now we've got, of course, multiple issues here. The press has been up in arms the last summer and this summer about drift, of course, because of the possible, the new formulation, the new stacked, what is it, the dicamba that drifts?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's one issue because there's an obvious, you know, if it drifts, things die and you see it. But even before that issue and underlying all of it, of course, is the rising use of glyphosate among other problems, which I don't feel we don't have a handle on that. What do you think, Kamyar?
Yeah, well, what he described was basically a steep increase since 2006 of use of glyphosate, dicamba, and 2,4-D.
Now,
combination.
Glyphosate, of course, is finally. I would you say that it's fair to draw the parallel with the tobacco companies and the, you know, there was a time when everybody thought smoking was safe, and then there started to be some rumbling about it, especially in the scientific community, and then there were a lot of lawsuits. So I think that glyphosate is sort of on the same trajectory. The UN, part of the UN has declared that it's a possible carcinogen. The state of California says that glyphosate is a possible carcinogen. Of course, the companies that manufacture it flat out deny it. There are legal challenges. There's been some discovery that perhaps Monsanto is hiding negative scientific evidence. I mean, what do we got going on here, Kamyar?
Well, yeah, all of those things are, yeah, I mean, the thing is, yes, the parallel with smoking is very, very relevant here. When you have a large volume of pesticides used, and there are high risk pesticides, and there's going to be public health impacts, and again, in his presentation, he outlined a large number of those studies. And so it's really the difference between the smoking and this is that we made progress on smoking. We haven't really made much progress on pesticides yet. Yes, there have been like a few pesticides were banned. Again, years later, a lot of foot dragging. And so basically we have a chemical regulatory system that kind of gives the benefit of the doubt to the chemical rather than to public health. So that's kind of the situation we're in. And that's why we need more awareness of the situation, that we have kind of large volumes of highly hazardous chemicals at large in our state every year, in agriculture, in urban areas, and most of them are unnecessary. And so that's the situation we're in, and that's partly why I believe that state officials and university researchers and all of us really need to kind of pay closer attention to what we know from science about the harm that these particular pesticides can cause.
Well, this is, and let's just push the analogy a little bit further. In the smoking scenario in tobacco, individuals had a choice. Did they smoke? Did they not smoke? Right? With pesticides, particularly in Iowa, you could say that with that analogy, Iowa is like a very heavy smoker. We have a lot of those chemicals in the state, particularly heavily loaded because we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, right? So Iowans, we really need to pay attention to this.
The parallel actually exists because of secondhand smoking, right? Mm-hmm. So secondhand smokers didn't have a choice when you went into a restaurant. Some people smoked, and you unfortunately smoked secondhand. And in Iowa, the same thing. So you're exposed to pesticides secondhand through drift, through drinking water, and other ways. You could, in urban areas, you could be exposed to them as well. So yes, there is secondhand exposure very
okay,
much.
So
though farmers and applicators are at most risk, farmers
right.
and farm families are at most risk, and their neighboring farms are at risk. So we heard in Iowa City, we heard a presentation on schools that are adjacent to farms. There could be drift. We learned about examples of drift, not just in Iowa, but in neighboring states, in all over the Midwest.
This stuff is made to kill things. That's why they sell it, to put on weeds. And then we sort of forget that we are also living organisms, and things can affect us. The concept of drift, of things drifting, that's coming more into the fore over the past few years. And as a small-scale vegetable farmer, that sort of thing just terrifies me, because talk about a power play. It seems like in when something drifts, you can say, oh, look, you've killed all of my tomatoes. But then the recourse is on the small farmer to prove that it happened, for one thing. And I've yet to see anyone being held accountable for this drift stuff. There is a bit of news that I've been following. There is a large peach orchard in Missouri this spring, and those peaches actually find their way up to Iowa. The peach orchard is named Bader, B-A-D-E-R. And this spring, well, actually it happened last year too, but this spring was the final straw. Drift killed the peaches.
Oh, this is the dicamba drift.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
And yeah. And it killed all those trees. And so, yes, it does affect us because I doubt we'll see boxes of Bader peaches up here because they found their way up to Central Iowa. I always kind of look forward to buying a box of those peaches. The idea of drift is a scary, scary sort of thing. Are the people that are caught spraying the dicamba actually being held accountable? Do you know?
Boy, I haven't followed those cases, though he talked, Dr. Benbrook mm-hmm. talked about quite a few of them mm-hmm. at mm-hmm. his talk in Ames. Those are all these cases. We know there have been crop damage to neighboring farms, millions of acres of them all over the country, because, the neighboring farms did not have their dicamba-ready feature in their seeds, and so their crops were damaged.
Oh, talk about that. It's not just spraying in general, but there are these seeds that are supposed to be compatible with these poisons that are sprayed, and that's a big industry too.
Yeah. Well, again, my understanding of it is kind of limited, but all I know is that dicamba and 2,4-D have been engineered into these crops so that they can withstand those particular herbicides. And if you happen not to, if you happen to have planted a crop that is not ready, kind of cannot, is not resistant to those herbicides, then your crops will be damaged.
Like peaches.
So like those peaches, yeah.
So, yes, oh my goodness.
And it turns out that dicamba apparently is very, it volatilizes at the warmer it gets, the more it volatilizes. So it gets in the air and then it, more than others apparently.
The issue, and this is just a little more of the background, the issue of why we even have dicamba, the newly stacked, just available for the last 2 years in the original genetically modified formulations is because weeds become resistant. So we are getting huge resistance, to glyphosate.
Yes.
So the chemical companies, in their wisdom, it's called the pesticide treadmill, decided, well, we need more than glyphosate. So now they have created this new product in the last 2 years, which adds the dicamba on to the glyphosate stack.
And 2,4-D.
Okay, right, and 2,4-D. So we're getting a heavier pesticide burden with even more chemicals coming.
Let me just add that these are herbicides that were introduced to the market long ago without mm-hmm. proper, protocols, and they have been grandfathered in to stay on the market. And I mean, the whole process of the review is highly political. It's not like just a team of health scientists and physicians sit and discuss these. No, commodity groups come and weigh in, and so it's a very political thing.
And it's not necessarily based on the safety of public
children,
health.
Yeah. And yeah. women, and elderly, and all number of others who. Now, let me kind of bring up an important distinction here, because if somebody's listening, they'll say, oh, you're kind of against farmers. We're trying to farm here and stuff like that. So I just want to emphasize that this is not a statement, quote, against farmers, okay? It's a statement about a practice that seemed to be harmful.
And harmful primarily to farmers.
And to farmers. So this is, we're not trying to be judgmental, saying, look, farmers are out there doing these horrible things and these farmers are so bad. No, what I'm saying, and I think most of us are saying, is that we have a system in place that we're all part of, and this system is not helpful to us, and we need to seek alternatives to this system. And it turns out that alternatives to this system do exist.
We need to figure that
this is really urgent, that once we know, which we already do, that this widespread use of vast quantities of weed killers, fungicides, and insecticides that are broadcast all over the state is not helpful to us, that it's causing trouble, we have the duty, public officials, faculty members, everyone has the duty to make people aware of these harms and seek alternatives.
Yes, help us. We want to solve this problem.
Yes, and it turns out there are quite a few farmers out there demonstrating that you can grow high-yielding variety, high-yielding, good production of crops, livestock, vegetables, without using vast quantities of pesticides. And that's really where the conversation, what we really need to focus on, is that, yes, we can talk for a long time about health hazards of every one of these pesticides. At the end of the day, we need to focus on how elevate alternatives to these pesticides and incentivize them.
Because the market principles, the chemical companies that are making these agricultural products, they make a lot of money off of this. They're not going to just say, and they advertise their products and they reach out to farmers selling them this product. So how can we counterweight this large business financial interest?
I don't know. All I know is that we need to go with evidence, with science, and reach out and offer alternatives and offer practices that are based on science and evidence, that work, that are practical, that are viable financially. That's our task.
For farmers,
that's
yes.
The task for Iowa is to figure this out. And it turns out that actually, you probably know there are quite a few researchers at ISU and at other universities who have taken the time to demonstrate and to research that these alternatives are possible. And actually, a lot of farmers at Practical Farmers of Iowa, Iowa Organic Association, so many entities have demonstrated that it's entirely possible. And it's just that to have good cropping systems that are practical, everything works with far, far fewer pesticides or none at all. And we need to reach out. We need to figure a way of organizing ourselves in every county. We need to have presence in every county. And just like Practical Farmers of Iowa have members in every county. So we got to keep talking, keep demonstrating and making these practices visible and known to public decision makers, public officials, legislators. So, I don't think of it as fighting the pesticide companies. I'm thinking of it as, hey, this is our state, this is who we are, and we're going to work with each other and figure this out. Nobody's going to do this for us, right? We just got to do it.
Sounds good to me.
So Chuck Benbrook's visit really is kind of part of that attempt to elevate issues of pesticide so that people know more about it and give them science and evidence.
Right. We've got the science and we've got the solutions.
And we've got the solutions, exactly.
You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are in the kitchen today with Kamyar and Cheyenne. We're talking about pesticides in us, how it affects us. These things are designed
in Iowa.
Yeah, in Iowa, these pesticides are designed to take care of those what we consider nasty weeds and help people make more money on the commodities we grow here in Iowa. But there seems to be consequences. Kamyar has been talking about a visit by Chuck Benbrook, who talked about pesticides in Iowa. What I'm concerned about, or I would like to talk about, Kamyar, is the fact that there's not a lot of information unless you really dig for it. It seems like this should be public information. Well, I suppose it is, but like you said, some people are not so happy when this information comes out. It is very political.
Yeah, I mean, it's basic stuff, right? How many pounds of pesticides are applied on corn? How many pounds per on soybean and on other crops? There should be good records of these every year, clear to Iowans, and by county by county. There should be numbers for all of this, but it's very hard to get hold of those numbers.
And would this be the job of, like, IDOLs or...
Yeah, IDOLs should be able to do that, you know.
So what on the governmental or public health on the state level, what can we ask for? What can be done?
When Dr. Benbrook was here, I asked him after his presentation. I said, "Well, what are some of the things that we should be doing in Iowa, given kind of in the context of millions of pounds of herbicides used in Iowa annually, and then there are all these public health issues based on biomonitoring studies, etc., right? So there's health issues like reproductive problems, birth defects, you know, developmental impacts, cancers, etc. Well, he suggested several things. He suggested that somebody, it could be Iowa Department of Public Health or other partners, to, you know, have some biomonitoring studies, basically monitoring levels of pesticides in people. I don't know if those are going on or not. There are researchers at the University of Iowa or in Des Moines who might be studying that, but these aren't very publicized easily. You know, we don't know about them. Anyway, that was one of his suggestions. And the other one was that Iowa Department of Agriculture should make data available, right? We should know as we go. We should know, okay, what are the trends in pesticides use? Which pesticides are used in which counties?
And at what quantity, right?
And in what quantity. So that, let's say, if you're a physician and you might see patterns of exposure to certain pesticides, you might those information may be useful to you. Right now, it's just like nothing. There's basically nothing. I mean, the latest data I've tried to look up was 2014.
Ah. You know?
And that's not county by county. That's just like overall.
Uh-huh. So there's nothing that, say, the local doctor or healthcare professionals can turn to that would help them understand, say, the symptoms of their patients.
Well, now that's totally outside of my kind of what I know, but I have, from talking with with physicians that I know, is that pesticide exposure diagnosis is not easy. You know, it's pretty complex, and most physicians may not be trained in that. But you would think we really do need workshops. Kind of professional development opportunities for physicians to better diagnose pesticide exposure, because we have a lot of it in Iowa.
That's true. The idea of monitoring this and making it public knowledge. After all, many years, not so long ago, we just started to realize that excessive exposure to the sun was not so good, and occasionally you get warnings that, oh, that's, you better put on your sunscreen now. We get weather reports. We get stock reports. We get sports score reports every night on the news. We should updating us on what's going on in our environment, it seems it would be a good public service.
Yeah, yeah. Other suggestions, kind of next step, and I think the one that he, Dr. Benbrook, emphasized, which I think is really a very important one, he said that there needs to be some push to ask that non-herbicide tolerant seeds become available for next year. Because we're already, this year, people have already purchased their seeds and planted them, and they are probably dicamba and 2,4-D tolerant. If we don't want more dicamba and 2,4-D and glyphosate used, then we need to ask the seed companies, farmers and others need to ask seed companies to plant those non-herbicide tolerant varieties now so that there will be more seeds next year, so that farmers would not have to spray dicamba and 2,4-D.
Okay, so is there's a limited amount? I mean, I know obviously there's the organic market where they have to have these kinds of seeds, but is there a limited amount of traditional, conventional, non-GMO
probably.
Seeds?
Probably. I don't know. Wow. I really don't know.
Oh, so what happens if you plant dicamba-ready, 2,4-D-ready seeds and don't spray them? Do they not grow or what?
No. They'll probably grow. I really don't know.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
You would just have to. It's just that the logic is that if you have them, you're going to use them.
Aha.
And
right.
The idea is if you don't have them, then particularly if the neighboring farmers, then you know if there's restrictions for their use because your neighbors aren't, you know, because of drift, everybody needs to be more careful. I mean, that's the thing. We're not, I mean, there's, I mean, a basic understanding of environment, right? That's what environmental education is all about, is that we're not by ourselves sitting, you know, with nobody around. Whatever you do moves around, right?
Right, right.
And so we just need to understand that we live with our, I mean, people understand the idea of neighborliness, and so that's all we're asking. There's more than just my farm and my garden and my lawn. There are other people around me, and whatever I do to my land, it's going to affect other people.
It seems we forget. It's so easy just to buy something or go online and fix it. The sun shines, the wind blows, water does run downhill. I don't think those things are going to change, and those things affect us, especially when the wind and the water can carry these things. I am surprised to find out how long these pesticides last. The idea of, oh, put it on and then your problems go away. Well, it doesn't sound like you put it on and your problems go away. It sounds like they last and get in the groundwater. That doesn't sound too good.
Yeah, yeah. That's stuff moves around.
You mentioned lawns too. I mean, we've been talking
right.
about
it's about, not just agricultural.
Right. We've been talking about big fields of corn. We're thinking about or peaches or something. But what do you have anything to say about what people put on their lawns, Camier?
I have a lot to say. So, you know, I can totally understand the farmer situation where they have to make a living. Weeds compete with yield, and you got to have some way of controlling weeds. But in town, you know, again, decades of marketing has convinced people that to be a good neighbor and good American, you got to spray your lawn and it has to look a particular way. And so people in town go and buy, you know, large quantities of, you know, the same herbicides. Actually, every typical lawn herbicide has 2,4-D and dicamba in it.
Oh, my.
And and they're applied, you know, in significant quantities. We're in the middle of estimating that for several cities, but we did it for Cedar Falls. We estimated about something like, very conservatively, 2,800 pounds of very hazardous herbicides are applied on lawns in Cedar Falls every year.
What? And it all comes in those nice little handy things you get from the garden center, just, you know, a little quarter at a time or whatever. That is a lot. Well, you know something's up when the lawn services come and they do their thing, and then they put these little signs on the lawn that says, don't let your kid or your dog come on this lawn because it's not so good. We should realize that something's up.
So, yeah, I mean, and there is good evidence that those pesticides applied to urban areas do run off, do end up in urban streams. And we know that they also kill all the food source for a lot of pollinators. So my lawn has a diversity of plants in it, and a lot of pollinators, that's source of food for a lot of pollinators. And
what is in your lawn? Because come here, my lawn is creeping Charlie.
Okay, well, my lawn has dandelions, has violets, has clover, several kinds, and so they're all good. And it has creeping Charlie, which is also good.
tell me how creeping Charlie is good. I need to hear this.
So the idea is, well, again, diversity is good, right?
Well, my creeping Charlie is oozing out everything else.
So the thing is, it's all in our head, right? It's all in our head. We've gotten in our head that there's something, your lawn has to look a particular way for you to be a good neighbor. And so we're in our second year, we've started a statewide campaign to kind of change our cultural attitude towards lawns.
Good idea.
And that campaign is called Good Neighbor Iowa. So we have a website you can go to. It's goodneighboriowa.org. And it shows the leadership of so many entities across Iowa, school districts, parks, childcare centers, all these entities that have committed to manage their lawns without spraying them. And there are ways of managing your lawn so that it's not entirely run over by creeping Charlie. So, you know, it's even possible to manage athletic fields in ways that require very little herbicides or none at all. Again, it's kind of like farming, again.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a lot more doable, too. And so, you know, it's just for cosmetic purposes. So we're asking schools and parks and childcare centers to commit to managing their lawns without resorting to these harmful substances for health reasons, you know.
So this is goodneighbor.org. Lana and I, we have ongoing creeping Charlie jokes.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's a pretty amazing thing. They really are good. This idea of having a lawn that looks a certain way. We believe anything we see on TV or whatever is marketed toward us. I mean, the idea of having these little square patches of green grass, I'm sure, well, actually, I know this for a fact. Just think, before lawnmowers, before 1900. So what did people do? My goodness, did they get down there with this pair of scissors? No, come on now, people.
They let the sheep or the goats out, right?
That's the idea. I read someplace that the idea of a sweep of green grass in front of your yard. Only the very, very rich could afford to just have grass just to look at. And that was probably grazed by sheep. They do a pretty good job, but somebody had to manage it for that and all kinds. So it is a status thing. And although our lawn may be just, 20 feet by 20 feet, we somehow think it has to just look as if it's been mowed off.
Our own private fiefdom.
Well, okay.
Fiefdom, yeah.
You know, in several other states have already kind of gotten over that issue.
Aha.
In the state of New York, no schools are allowed to use any pesticides on their lawns for cosmetic purposes.
Oh, none. My goodness. That sounds like a good idea.
Similar laws have been enacted in Connecticut and maybe a few other states, and then several provinces in Canada have totally outlawed cosmetic uses of lawns everywhere. Cosmetic uses of pesticides on lawns, not just in schools, but anywhere, you know. So people, you know, it is totally a made-up thing, you know, and we got to kind of get over it.
It's harmful, particularly to children.
Yeah, it seems like we kind of have understood it for organizations. You know, if you go to a university or to a school district, everybody says, oh, well, we, you know, diversity and inclusion is, you know, is our, in our strategic plan, and we have hired a chief diversity officer and all that, which is great because it acknowledges that there are many kinds of us, and we're all people, and we need to respect one another, et cetera, et cetera. But we can't handle diversity in the lawn. We just can't stand it. The same schools will kill diversity on their lawns.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and also, this maybe another big step is diversity in our agriculture. That,
yes.
You know, those words are starting to be used, sustainability, diversity, being more gentle with the land. We have many, many things to learn, I think. Yes.
That's true.
Well, and we haven't mentioned there are other parts of the world besides New York State where, like, the European Union is taking a very different position on some of these. There was a consideration for banning glyphosate altogether. And now they're going to revisit that in 5 years. There are many countries that they just don't want to use these products.
Well, they have banned atrazine, and for very good reasons. And in Iowa, 6-7 million pounds of atrazine are applied every year.
Oh, see, these numbers, it should be like, well, we have to talk about this around our kitchen table, all over, not just this kitchen table, but let's talk about it at supper this evening with your family.
So just to be clear, in Iowa, we are now discussing more and more water quality because it has become quite an issue. Now, mostly people are talking about nitrates in the water, which are fertilizers. However, the other part of the discussion that I hope we're deepening is the level of pesticides in the water, in the air, in the soil. And this is a big part of water quality.
Well, and the solutions that kind of solve our water quality problems are the same solutions that will solve our pesticide problems. These are really not problems, they're manifestations of problems. And the problem, the root of the problem, is that we have a system of cropping that requires only two crops. And we've planted our entire state into these two crops.
And corn and soy.
And you cannot have water quality if you cover the entire state with these two crops. There is no solution unless we change these two crops to have a lot less of them so that we have a lot other possibilities for our state.
Well, now, of course, that's a big, big change. So what are some of the solutions that do have good research on are introducing a third small grain into the rotation. That's one solution. What are some of the things that farmers can do to sort of break this cycle of corn and soy and corn and soy that is still profitable, of course?
Well, that's why you should have some farmers on your show to answer that. I mean, I can't. I'm not at a point where I can what farmers ought to do or ought not do. That's not my. But all I know from what I've learned from farmers I know is that they have demonstrated that it is possible to have high yielding crops and diversity on their farms. And the question is, how can we create that opportunity for many more farms? I don't think the solutions are crystal clear, but we know we have good sense of which direction will help us. And I think we got to move in that direction. We got to explore. We got to have conversation instead of
more research.
Demonstration, research, policy analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, what policies will help us? What policies are not helping us? what policies are keep pushing us in this direction where we're in the pesticide treadmill? So we gotta talk about all of these things.
And do you think that if there's more public health research, that will help us to clarify what the issues are and perhaps bring different kinds of agricultural research to help change the basic commodity farming in this state? This is a big needle to move here.
Exactly. Well, that's why we need everybody's sensibilities and insights to help us move that needle. I don't know if we need, I'm of the mind that we already know pretty much everything we need to know to make big changes. And it's not like, wow, we need to do a lot more research. We already know the current patterns are harmful in many levels, from soil erosion to water contamination. There's just so many ways the current patterns in agriculture in Iowa are not helpful to Iowa. And they're not helpful to other parts of the world either.
And they're not helpful to farmers if they're going to end up with...
And they're not helpful to rural communities in Iowa either, right? But we do know other patterns that we have robust evidence that they work. Like you mentioned, a lot of what practical farmers of Iowa farmers are practicing, you know, new market, local food systems, diversifying... more habitat in Iowa, more, crop rotation. There's just so many of them, and we need to make those work for us.
Right. I noticed Dr. Benbrook talked about Dr. Matt Liebman's concept of mini little hammers, which he has done research about for a long time. Now, he's the Wallace Chair at ISU, and his mini little hammers are some of the things that you've been talking about, different rotations. Can you explain a little bit of the mini little hammers?
I think you should have...
Okay, we'll call Matt
others.
And get him on. Okay.
You got to have him and others to talk about his amazing... he and his colleagues and others at ISU have done really pioneering work in demonstrating the multiple benefits of a diverse agriculture and diverse cropping systems and prairies on farms. And it really is amazing work, and that needs a lot more attention. And it would be great to figure ways of making the results of their studies more visible to Iowans. I've been trying.
Okay, we will all be trying. And good job, Kamyar, for bringing Dr. Chuck Benbrook to Iowa and once again raising all of these issues. And I think it's particularly important about the public health meetings that you had at the University of Iowa. And I do hope you'll get more results from that. And if you've got more news, give us a call. We're happy to talk about this because that is good news. So thank you so much for all the work that you do.
Sure. Well, thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, we have fun doing it, at least, right?
Good, good. We've been talking to Kamyar Enchayan. He is at UNI, University of Northern Iowa. He's the director
of the Center
for Energy and Environment.
Environmental education.
Oh, good job.
There we go.
And he's been talking with us today about how pesticides in our environment, of which there are an awful lot
right here in Iowa, right in our back and front yard, so to
how
speak.
How that affects us. So thank you, Kamir.
Nice to be with you.
Good. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We talked about pesticides today. Not a happy subject.
And herbicides.
And herbicides. Things that we want to be aware of, because we are part of this. Like I often say, we're all in this together.
Yep. This is an Iowa issue.
Here in the Donalana Kitchen, over the past weeks, as we've gone from spring to summer rather rapidly, we've been considering the different smells that happen. And we've kind of had the scent of the week. I want to concentrate on a scent of the week called peonies.
The peonies had just popped. I guess it's the heat. It's like they were tight little balls, and then all of a sudden they're out in their full fluffy glory.
They are fluffy, and they are glorious.
They are.
It's nice to celebrate that sort of thing. I do like the smell of a peony. And I found out by planting a couple of different kinds of peonies that not all peonies smell. Some are just made for the
Some are
look.
Just beautiful.
They're just beautiful. That's all. Anyway, to celebrate peonies, I would like to read a poem here. A poem by Mary Oliver about peonies. There's a little note here that says, "Peonies, the scent of peonies is often connected with the yoga center, the chakra of the heart. Peonies and the heart, they go together. So, this is a poem called Scent Hive by Mary Oliver. This morning, the green fists of the peonies are getting ready to break my heart as the sun rises, as the sun strokes them with his old buttery fingers, and they open, pools of lace, white and pink, and all day the black ants climb over them, boring their deep and mysterious holes into the curls, craving that sweet sap and taking it away to their underground cities. And all day, under the shifty wind, as in a dance to the great wedding, the flowers bend their bright bodies and tip their fragrance to the air and rise their red stems, holding all that dampness and recklessness, gladly and lightly. And there it is again. Beauty, the brave, the exemplary, blazing open. Do you love this world? Do you cherish your humble and silky life? Do you adore the green grass with its terror beneath? Do you also hurry half-dressed and barefoot into the garden and, softly exclaiming of their dearness, fill your arms with the white and pink flowers, with their honeyed heaviness, their lush trembling, their eagerness to be wild and perfect for a moment before they are nothing forever?" It's a poem about peonies by Mary Oliver.
I think I'd like to have a whole lawn full of peonies.
Just they don't last long, but here they are, the start of summer, and it is very good. It's very good.
And we are peony perfect right now. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
Donalana Kitchen comes to you every Tuesday at noon, repeated Tuesday evening at 7 p.m., support this fine community radio station. Visit us here at the station anytime at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. We've had music today by Neil Hellman and William Coulter and Friends. We'll go out with a little tune called Emma's Waltz, played on a mountain dulcimer. Yes, that's nice. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering today by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.